There are moments in life that split everything into before and after. For Jennifer Ballou, that moment came in Afghanistan. She was a first sergeant on her deployment there, deep into the mission when she was called back to the office late at night. Her commander had news that her husband, also deployed to Afghanistan, had been hit by an IED. She got down to fly south to hopefully to see him as he was being treated. Instead, she arrived to the news that he had passed away just before his 35th birthday. From that point on, nothing was the same. She came home, raised her kids, kept leaving soldiers, and tried to find her footing in a world that had quite literally shifted out from under her feet. Over time, she found ways to turn this loss into impact by shaping Army's policy for Gold Star families and stepping into her role as the Chief of Staff at the Global War on Terrorism Memorial Foundation. Today, she shares her story about grief, service, resilience, and why remembering these stories matter. Before we start, though, I do want to mention something important to our community, the Global War on Terrorism Memorial Foundation. The foundation is building a permanent national memorial in Washington, D.C. to honor everyone affected by this war, service members, families, and civilians alike. This memorial is there to make sure that their sacrifices are remembered for generations to come. To learn more or support this mission, visit gwantmemorialfoundation.org or check out the rest of this episode to find out more about it. Hey, Jen, welcome to the show. I'm really glad to have you here, and I've been looking forward to this conversation for quite some time, but I'm glad we finally got this on the calendar, and we're going to get this conversation going.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Likewise, I've been looking forward to this for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. Just as background for folks who don't know you, you and I, we met at the Military Influencer Conference last year in 2024, and you guys were gracious enough to bring me on to the Global War on Terrorism Memorial Foundation as a fellow, and it's been an amazing experience so far, and I'm sure we'll get into more into that and more into the foundation and everything in a little bit. But for folks who maybe aren't familiar with you and your background, tell us a little bit about yourself. You know, you were in the Army, kind of deployments and all that kind of stuff. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure. So hi, my name is Jennifer Ballou. I am a mother of three. I currently live right outside of Columbus, Ohio. I am an Army veteran. I served in the Army for right under 21 years. I retired in 2015, which is crazy. It's been about 10 years since I've retired. I currently serve as the Chief of Staff for the Global War on Terrorism Memorial Foundation, which again, I'm sure we'll talk about more. What else? I don't know. I recently completed my master's degree in yoga therapy, which was a really long journey and something that I'm super proud of. And I don't know. That's probably good enough.
No, that's good. That's good. And, you know, it gives just a little flavor to your background and, you know, serving in the Army and all that. And, you know, for what you said, like 10 years you've been retired, it must seem like, I don't know, to you, does it seem like it was just yesterday that you were in, or does it seem like it's been a while?
Yeah, that's a great question. It depends on the day. I mean, it doesn't feel like 10 years. But at the same time, there are certain things that have changed about the Army in specific that I do feel very out of touch from. So maybe a little bit of both.
Yeah. Yeah. I know even just looking at like the uniform now is different from the uniform that I forget when they made that change, but from when I got out, it was a different uniform. And, you know, so I'm looking at that and I start to feel the bones creaking and aching as I'm realizing I'm in the older generation that wore the older uniform, right?
Yeah. I mean, especially when I'm around military installations, a big one for me is the female uniform. Like women can now wear their like hair back in a ponytail, like down, and they can also wear earrings, stuff like that. Just was right. Not a thing when I was serving. So lots of changes.
That's cool. So you deployed to Afghanistan, correct?
I deployed.
Yeah. And while you were there, kind of a sad and but also interesting story as well. Tell us a little bit about that deployment and kind of what took place for you there.
Yeah, sure. So I was the first sergeant for the 257th Dental Company, which was part of the 44th Medical Brigade at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. We were the first dental company to deploy to Afghanistan, and our mission was to set up dental clinics throughout the country to primarily serve the warfighter. That was my first deployment, and it was something that I was really proud of and looking forward to and you know, trained and worked really hard in anticipation of that. During that time in my life, my husband, Eddie, who was an infantryman, was also in Afghanistan. He was serving on his fourth combat deployment. And the way that it was supposed to go was that he was finishing up his deployment as I was arriving. So there was going to be a period of probably about 2 months where we were both there. And then he would go home, redeploy, and take care of the kids while I finished out the rest of my year. I had been in Afghanistan for about 8 weeks and had gotten called back to the office late one evening for my commander to tell me that he had been notified that Eddie had been blown up. He was on a patrol and he got blown up by an IED. And in those moments, the information that I was given was that he was being evacuated. He had lost his left leg, but they were fighting really hard to keep him alive. And so Eddie was in the south, he was in the southern part of Afghanistan in the Kandahar area, and my headquarters was in the north in Bagram. And so I just remember him telling me, go pack a bag, we're going to get you there somehow. And so I did end up flying to Kandahar. And, you know, even though Eddie was an infantryman and on that particular deployment had lost quite a few men, both their lives and to injuries, this just wasn't something that I really thought would happen. I mean, I knew it could, but you just don't think about stuff like that, maybe is a better way to say it. And unfortunately, when I arrived to Kandahar, Eddie had passed away. He lost his life, which was June 24th, 2010, minutes before he turned 35, right before his 35th birthday. Yeah.
Wow. That's, I actually have like chills right now after, you know, hearing some of this story. And like, I knew parts of the story. I didn't know all the details of mm-hmm. your story. And so first off, thank you for sharing that. But I know the feeling of what you were talking about of, you know, he was an infantryman. You knew that that was a possibility that something could happen to him, but you kind of didn't really give it too much thought probably.
Yeah.
And I was the same way when my brother was an infantryman. I was an infantryman and we both were in Afghanistan at the same time. I didn't really give it much thought that something bad could happen to him because it was naive looking back on it now. And my thinking anyways was naive because I just thought that those bad things happen to other people and that won't affect us. That won't happen to us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know if that was the same kind of mindset that you had, but that for sure, that was what I was thinking in my situation.
Yeah. I think, you know, I don't know. I don't know if I would call it naive thinking. I mean, I just think as a service member, you have a mission. Mm-hmm. And in order to accomplish that mission, especially in a period of war or, you know, preparing to deploy, you have to keep your eye on what's ahead of you and try to not let yourself, you know, be swayed or thinking about too many other things. I mean, people always say to me too, you know, I don't know how you did it, how you, you know, left your kids. And it's like, well, I mean, I get those comments, but I think if you wear the uniform, you get it. Like, sure. It's not that I wanted to leave my kids or my family, but when we raise our right hand and we say that we're going to protect and defend our nation, you do what you're told to do.
Right, exactly. And yeah, the family, unfortunately, in some cases in the military, family sort of takes a backseat to what the mission is. And, you know, in your case, in your family's case, both you and your husband needed to be in a place on the other side of the world, away from your kids. Mm-hmm. You definitely didn't want to bring your family around that type of situation. Not that you could anyways, but you know, that was just a situation where they were better off where they were, you know, staying back home. And there was nothing really you could do about that, you know, and that's kind of part of the deal that we all signed up for. Now you came back, you know, obviously after that deployment. And did you come back kind of with your husband, kind of escorting him back home? Mm. Or was that, like, how did that all take place?
Yeah, that's a great question. I can say now that there was no better person to escort Eddie's flag draped casket back to the United States than me, but that was certainly one of the most difficult days of my life. So yes, I participated in the ramp ceremony and flew, you know, on multiple aircraft, bringing him back to the United States to Dover Air Force Base. Mm-hmm. And then I was met there by my casualty assistance officer and, you know, began this process of all of the things that go along with something like that happening. Ultimately, so like I mentioned, I was the first sergeant for a dental company. We had just gotten there. We had a big mission ahead of us. And it was almost another loss when the decision was made not to send me back. And although I do agree that that was the best decision for myself and my children, that was really tough for me to not go back with my company and finish what we started. So it was a really difficult time.
Yeah. I have chills just hearing some of the story because it parallels so much with my own story. And, you know, I didn't go back either. And you could see both sides of it, how it was good, but you also don't want to leave the folks that you were serving with back there. And so, you know, so it's definitely difficult. But, you know, while, you know, after coming back home and, you know, that decision was made for you to stay home, how did you balance that, the grief that you were dealing with? Plus, you know, at some point you were getting back into military life, right? That you retired a few years later. So, you know, how did you balance that all with, you know, responsibilities as a soldier, as a mother, and all of that? That I gotta imagine that was a very difficult time period to adjust to.
Yeah, I balanced it horribly, I think. Like, if I wish I knew then what I know now, like in terms of taking care of myself. You know, I all of a sudden became a single mom of two young children, who was also a senior NCO in the Army, who also months later was asked to help stand up the resilience program for the largest installation in the Army. And ultimately, I went to go work on that program at the Pentagon. And so it's interesting, like, I really believe that all of this happened for a purpose much larger than I can even understand today. But I still continued to give everything I had to the Army. And every time I was asked to do XYZ, I did it, you know, 100% that I could. And so, you know, my children continued to suffer. I did my best, or so I thought at the time. And they were sort of forced, especially my daughter, Alexis. I mean, my son, Eddie, was 2 at the time, and Alexis was 10 or 11. And I really put her in a position where she had to grow up really fast, because she ultimately took care of Eddie a lot. I would maybe come home and feed them dinner and then go back to work, or I was traveling a lot. So how did I balance it? I don't really know that I did super well. And I thank goodness, I thank God every day that they were super resilient and super understanding, even though they didn't have a choice. They kind of did.
Sure. I mean, I could see it going one of two ways, right? You could put the kids in a situation like that, and they do great, and they're resilient, and they're able to handle it really well, or could go the opposite way, and they start lashing out, and they start, you know, acting up and causing trouble and just making things that much worse for everyone, not just themselves, but for you and for other folks who are around. But it seems like they did okay with that. You know, obviously no one's going to do great and handle everything perfectly 100% of the time, because that's, I mean, they'd be robots if they were able to do that, right? So they're human, and so you can't expect perfection 100% of the time, and you know, especially in a difficult situation like, you know, losing a father, and you know, having to continue to work and everything, and which takes you away from them. It's not an easy thing, but you know, thankfully they were able to kind of handle that. You know, so I got to imagine that was probably one of the toughest parts about continuing your career, because you could have chosen to, you know, retire at that point and gotten out of the military at that point. You know, when your husband was killed, I'm sure they probably, you know, offered that option to you. Maybe not directly, but that option was there. But, you know, but then continuing that career afterwards, I would imagine the family life was probably one of the hardest things about it, right?
It definitely was. It definitely was. But, you know, like, as I'm thinking back on that time and just back to that question of balancing it, you know, there were things that I did to just ensure or try to ensure that my children understood to the best of their ability how important it was for me to continue serving while continuing to keep Eddie's memory alive. And so, you know, I found myself in a really interesting position just as a senior NCO in this situation. More often than not, the spouse, I mean, and you can relate to this in a different way, but typically, you know, the family is not wearing the uniform. Right. And so just, I had a different lens. I was able to see things a lot differently and was able to use my experience to positively affect or impact, for example, the way that the casualty notification and assistance officer training was delivered at Fort Bragg. I was able to share our story with so many different people in so many different situations, which I really quickly learned was not only helping other people, but it was also helping myself. And so circling back to my kids, just talking to them about those things, I think helped them to understand my decision to continue serving.
Well, and it also shows them too that it's okay to talk about these things. Like, there's going to be days you're going to feel sad, that you're going to miss dad, that you're going to be, you know, upset even or whatever, and that's normal. You're supposed to feel that way from time to time, you know, and it's also okay to talk about it. And showing them that, I think that's a good thing to be able to kind of lead by example in that way. I know, kind of just I had kind of the opposite reaction, you know, from my experience. I didn't handle this in a great way either, you know, so I think we all kind of just are thrown into the deep end and we have to kind of figure out how to tread water while we're in there. But I just kind of gave up and I said, you know, I don't even care about the Army anymore. I knew I wasn't going to be a good leader and I wasn't going to be a good soldier. And I said, you know what, these guys who I was in charge of, they deserve better. And that's why I decided to leave when I did, because I wasn't going to be the leader that they needed. And so, I knew that was only going to be, you know, self-serving if I stayed in to just be like, oh, well, this is my career and I'm doing this for me. I wasn't going to be a good soldier. I knew it just because I my head wasn't in the game anymore. And I decided to kind of walk away from it at that point. Now, I know you mentioned having some impact on the casualty assistance, you know, process and all that. What support did you get from them or from other folks throughout the military that you found to be helpful in this whole kind of process?
Oh, yeah. You know, I often say that had I not received the support that I did, I probably would have gone on a different path. The amount of support that I received from my military army family was tremendous. So my casualty assistance officer, Rebecca Leisman, who is now just a very dear friend, went above and beyond in every possible way that she could. But, you know, also my chain of command, all the way up to the highest levels, just did any and everything they could to try and support, you know, my kids and I, not just initially, but really throughout the rest of my career. I remember my last assignment was at the Pentagon, and my boss, his name is Colonel Ken Riddle. There were times where something would come up where I would potentially have to travel for it, and he would just try to make things not so difficult on me. And, you know, I didn't like that, actually. I made the decision to continue to serve, and I don't want to be treated differently than anyone else. But to those around me, I think they saw it from a different lens. Like, wow, she's wanting to continue to do this. If we can make things a little less difficult on her or her kids, we want to try to do that. So, I mean, I could go on and on, but I had arms wrapped around me from the very first moment until well after I left the Army.
Yeah. And I can kind of see it both ways. I see your point of like, hey, I made this decision. I'm a grown up. I can make these decisions, and you don't have to treat me differently. But on the other hand, I could see the other side of it where, look, you've already given up so much. Yeah. You know, how can we ask you to do anything more? You know, and if we can make it, whatever we are asking you to do, if we can make it just that much easier for you, then we're going to try to do that. And so I could see it both ways. And, you know, I don't think there's any right or wrong way to approach it, but, you know, it's a difficult balance, I suppose. Right.
And,
yeah. Go ahead.
No, I just thought of something else. I had this experience where shortly after Eddie died, I was put on assignment PCS to Fort Leonardwood, Missouri to be a first sergeant there. And I mean, without going into too much detail, some pretty high level service members basically told me, you chose to stay in the Army, so either you take this assignment and you go be first sergeant again, or you get out. Like, those are your choices. I was just like, holy wow. And there were leaders that were a little bit higher than that that caught wind of it and took care of the situation for me and allowed me to stabilize at Fort Bragg just for a little bit longer until I was able to get my footing again and, you know, be able to have my personal affairs in order.
Yeah. Well, so I suppose there is a wrong way to handle it. You know, looking at that, yeah, that's probably not the best way to handle these things. It's like, here, you know, either take this job or get out, or, you know, whatever. And I don't know, that kind of rubbed me the wrong way as you were saying it. I was like, oh, like whoever said that was, they definitely didn't have the bedside manner that they probably should have had, you know. But, you know, it's again, it's a difficult balance. And where do you draw that line of, you know, treat you like everybody else, and hey, yeah, also recognize that there was a pretty large sacrifice there, and
yeah.
You know, there's a, where do you draw that line? And I suppose everyone's going to treat it a little bit differently, right? Now, were there anything, like, if you were to look back at this whole experience, anything that you felt like the Army did well or maybe didn't do well to prepare families for this type of reality?
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, I mean, again, I just feel like I was in a little bit different of a situation because I was also wearing the uniform. And so a lot of the things that organizations do to prepare families for these, especially combat deployments, I wasn't necessarily participating in because I was doing my own thing as well. But I do want to speak more to, like, after it happened.
Sure.
So preparing us for it, I mean, we were prepared, I think, as much as we could be. But I mean, afterwards, I had some really great opportunities. I mentioned one, influencing the casualty assistance and notification training at Fort Bragg, but I also got to sit on the chief of staff of the Army has a Survivor Advisory Working Group, and it's a group of men and women who are Gold Star families from many different circumstances and situations. And I was one of two uniformed wearing Gold Star spouses. And I got to impact or influence Army policy. It was actually, there was a policy created where future service members in similar situations, they could choose to stabilize if they wanted to for a certain period of time, or maybe they don't want to stay where they are and they want a PCS somewhere else. And so having the opportunity and the voice heard at the highest levels on what that was like and being able to influence people in the future who experience similar situations was something that I don't take for granted.
Yeah, that's a kind of a powerful position to be in, to be, you know, on a panel or board of people who are, you know, basically directly influencing that type of policy through, you know, kind of the highest levels in within the Army. And that's, you know, you gotta realize that, like, just how much power is kind of being given to you by putting yourself in this situation. But who better really to talk to this than the people who have lived it before, and, you know, where you can look back and say, gosh, I really wish this was handled differently. I wish it went this way instead of that way, or, you know, that we had, you know, this type of resource or that type of resource. And being able to voice those opinions, I think, is important, because when you have people at the very top of the chain of command who've maybe never experienced stuff like this before, you may bring a point up in the discussion that they had never even considered before, because they hadn't lived through that before. Not to say that they're stupid or anything like that. Like, you know, very intelligent people, I'm sure, you know, in terms of, you know, who was involved with all this. But if you don't experience something for yourself, sometimes you don't know what you don't know until it happens. And, you know, even you, just, you know, a few days prior to your husband's passing, you didn't know what you didn't know either, you know, and it's like, that's not to blame anybody. It's just, you know, once when you start living through it, then you get the experience, and then you can start, you know, speaking from that experience to kind of help other folks out. And so I'm glad that they, you know, kind of made the best of a bad situation, where they were able to bring people in with those experiences. Yeah, terrible experiences, but hey, you had to live that experience anyways. You might as well, you know, make lemonade out of those lemons, right? You know, make something good out of it, and try to help other Gold Star families who will come after you with some of these policy changes. And that's a real powerful thing that you did. And yeah, I think, I don't know that I would be able to turn something like that down. Had that been offered to me, like, hey, we have this position here and you could do, you know, X, Y, and Z, that probably would have kept me in the Army, you know, because I would have been like, yeah, there were, I had some words that could have been said, you know?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, that opportunity didn't come right away. It came, like, obviously after I had that experience where I was almost, you know, sent to Fort Leonardwood. And, you know, if I would have been sent to Fort Leonardwood, who knows what would have happened. But I am grateful for that opportunity. And something that I always would think about was, I mean, at the time I was a first sergeant, and I had access to the ear of some senior Army people that, you know, junior enlisted or junior soldiers probably didn't have that same opportunity or won't in the future. And so how can I use this opportunity to help those people who maybe their voices wouldn't be heard, or they don't have the opportunity that I did during that time? And so, yeah, it was a blessing, an interesting blessing, but a blessing nonetheless.
I want to switch gears just a little bit here. I know we briefly mentioned at the beginning of the episode the Global War on Terrorism Memorial Foundation, your work there as a chief of staff there, but you didn't start off as chief of staff. How did you get involved with the Global War on Terrorism Memorial Foundation, and, you know, what kind of led you into that direction and to get into your current role?
Yeah, thank you for that. Well, several years ago, I received a message on LinkedIn, actually, from the president and CEO of the Global War on Terrorism Memorial Foundation, Michael Rodriguez, just saying, you know, hey, I've been working really hard on this project for the last several years. I would love to give you an update on where things are. And I'm just thinking of absolutely. I knew a little bit about the work, but I didn't know where they were at that point. And so he graciously spent probably a solid hour just sharing everything with me, the two bills that had been passed and all of the hard work that had gone into the foundation up until that point. And at the end of the conversation, he said, you know, I know who you are. We're connected through his ex-wife, Kelly. I've known who you were for many years, and I've always wanted to have you a part of the team. I'm going to be starting a fellowship program, and I'd like to invite you to be our first Gold Star Fellow. And as you can probably relate to, there was zero hesitation. I said, yes, absolutely. So I'm honored that I got to be the foundation's first Gold Star Fellow, which is an opportunity really to help spread awareness about the work that the foundation is doing in different ways. And I say Rod made the mistake of telling me that at some point he wanted to bring me onto the team full time, but you know, stars had to align.
Sure.
And so I just made sure that I was very clear with him that if and when that situation presented itself, I was all in, no matter what the opportunity was. And so, yeah, in November of 2023, he offered me the opportunity to be the chief of staff, and I've been with the foundation ever since.
That's awesome. Yeah, and the foundation is such a great organization, not just the mission, but the people who are working for it. Everyone that I've met who is working for it has just been an incredible individual. So you guys have done a great job assembling a, you know, rock star team that is out there. But the important thing is the work that is being done for this memorial. And to me, when I first heard about the memorial, I was thinking to myself, finally, there's going to be something that's being built here, you know, for the global war on terrorism generation. I guess you could pluralize that even if you want, but you know, because it's been such a long, drawn out war. So many people were involved in it, not just from within the military, but civilians as well, through, you know, the FBI, the CIA, the, you know, DEA, all these other alphabet soup organizations that are out there, right? And but even the Gold Star families and you know the other military families that are involved when their loved one goes overseas to go fight in this war, they're left back home holding down the fort. And so when I first learned about this memorial, it was like, yeah, we recognize all these people. It's not just the people who didn't make it home, like your husband, my brother, and you know, countless others, but there's a lot of people involved, and we're you know, honoring and supporting all of these people. And I was like, that sounds awesome, because you don't want to, you know, have this memorial and then be like, oh yeah, we're forgetting about this whole other group of people. And you know, we're recognizing that this was truly a huge effort by people all over the country. And you know, it's not just the people who wore the uniforms. And you know, when I first learned of this memorial, I was thinking to myself, well, at least, you know, by the time this memorial is finished, I probably won't have to be wheeled off of an airplane to go visit the memorial like some of these World War II veterans, you know, who are going to see the World War II memorial, who are, you know, in their 90s or so, or even older. You know, that it's going to be something that, you know, I can walk to in my own 2 feet, and it's going to be there, you know, for generations to come. And I think it's just an incredible, you know, thing that's being done. And for the individuals who don't know about the memorial, you know, every time I talk to someone about it who hadn't heard about it before, they're like, wow, that's amazing. And they're super excited and really stoked about it. So it's really, truly a great project to be involved in. You know, for the Gold Star families, I kind of mentioned before, like that they're kind of included in this memorial and kind of who's being supported by it. I feel like, you know, you may be, you know, one of the more uniquely qualified people to speak on this, having served and also having been, you know, Gold Star family member. What do you hope that, you know, those families will be able to kind of take away from this memorial and get out of it?
Yeah, that's such a great question. You know, I always hesitate to speak on behalf of groups of people, sure, because I think that all of our experiences are unique to us. However, I do hope that the Gold Star families in particular feel as though their sacrifice was not in vain, their family sacrifice was not in vain, and that our nation recognizes that, you know, as these losses were happening and the rest of the nation was kind of like continuing on and not really thinking much about what we were doing over there, it wasn't for nothing. And we are eternally grateful for those sacrifices.
Yeah. You know, I was in DC a few years back, and I went for a run in the morning around the mall area. And when I got to the Vietnam Memorial and I saw all the names written on that wall, I stopped and I kind of like, I just slowly like walked by and I was looking at them. And to think that every single one of those names on that wall, they had parents, they had, you know, they had possibly, they were, could have been married, they could have had kids, they could have had, you know, other people. There's a person behind that name. It's not just a name etched in stone. There's a person, there's families, there's people who cared about that person. And when you look at that and you kind of just think of the gravity of, it's not just one name, you look at it and there's tens of thousands of names written all over the wall. Every one of those had a story. Everyone had a background, and everyone, you know, should be, you know, honored in a way that's fitting. And so, you know, I think that this memorial is going to do just that for this generation of this war, really, that, you know, everyone who participated in this in one way or another, it's going to be there to help kind of say, hey, we're not going to forget the sacrifices that were made, whether someone didn't make it home or they, you know, maybe didn't come home whole, you know, they could have lost something over there. And, you know, we're going to remember them, and we're going to remember everybody and all the sacrifices that were made, you know, big and small. And that's why I think it's so important that it's being done now and not, you know, waiting 50 years from now or, you know, something where, you know, it's at that point kind of a starting to fade out in people's memories. And so having something there, you know, concrete and solid in the moment of, you know, when it's still fresh in our minds is, I think, is important. You know?
Yeah. And something else I think is important to mention here too. I mean, you've done a good job of saying a few times that, you know, this memorial will honor absolutely those lives that were lost, but also the uniformed wearing men and women who served in the global war on terrorism, the non-uniformed wearing men and women, the families, those whose lives have been lost since returning home, perhaps by, you know, cancer or perhaps death by suicide or multiple other ways. This memorial will tell the whole story of all of the people who served and sacrificed in this war that continues today. I think that's the part that is really important too, is it's not only those who did, but those who are and will. So we're building a memorial for the future as well, for people who are currently and will continue to serve in this global war on terrorism that has no end in sight. So I just wanted to make sure I mentioned that as well.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And I kind of failed to mention that. But yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize what you just said there to be true, that, you know, this is kind of an ongoing thing. This is not, you know, like it wasn't done just because we pulled out of Afghanistan, you know, back in, you know, four years ago now, just because we pulled out of there. That wasn't the end of the war. I mean, that was the end of our time in Afghanistan, you know, for sure, but it doesn't mean that there aren't still troops being deployed overseas. I mean, there there's people going all over, and there's still fight to be had. So, you know, I think that is an important thing. And, you know, even among some service members, I think, and veterans, they don't necessarily realize that it's still an ongoing thing. And so this is a big piece of that. And I'm glad that you mentioned that, because, you know, that is an awareness piece that we need to, you know, make people understand is that there's still a fight going on, and it's, yeah.
Yeah. Education is a huge part of our role, or our mission, if you will, is just ensuring that any opportunity that we get to educate about the global war on terrorism and or who this memorial will honor is something that we do every chance that we get.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know just through the few events that I've participated in, as far as, you know, kind of talking about the memorial and everything about it, you know, it seems like it's touching to everybody, whether they served or not, just knowing that there's something that's going to be there. And it's really important to keep that education piece going to help, you know, raise awareness and make sure that people understand what this is all about. If you were able to speak directly to other families of the fallen, you know, coming from your background, your perspective as a veteran, as a Gold Star family member, but if you could speak directly to some of them, what message would you want to leave them with as far as, you know, what this memorial is, you know, from your perspective, not saying, you know, kind of in general, you know, for everybody, but you know, maybe a better way to phrase that is, what's the importance of this memorial to you specifically?
Yeah, well, thank you for that question. The foundation has four tenets that are really our North Star, or, you know, the things that keep us on a path moving forward, and they are honor, heal, empower, and unite. And so this memorial will do those things. We will honor the lives that have been lost in this ongoing war, as well as the other groups of people who I mentioned, or we've mentioned, that have served and sacrificed, honor, heal. We know that this memorial will provide an opportunity for healing in many different ways that will make more sense once the design is public. Honor, heal, empower. This memorial will empower others to share stories and experiences that perhaps that they haven't, and unite. This memorial will unite many different groups of people, but more largely our nation. We know that this memorial will unite all Americans and help them understand everything that our men and women have given everything for.
Absolutely. That's really, I think, wonderfully said, and really kind of what motivates me about this memorial and gets me kind of fired up, is that it touches on all of those points, and it's going to bring a lot of people together. It's going to heal some people. It's going to just really make us all stronger and better off together through the work that we're all doing here for this memorial. So I think with that, though, it's been an incredible conversation. You definitely have an incredible history and background. And, you know, I don't think they could have picked a better person for the role that you have. And I think it's only going to get better, you know, as the design comes out and things really start progressing forward, and we'll start to see some momentum here shortly when this design is eventually released. But before we wrap up, is there anything else that you'd like to add that maybe we didn't cover, either about your personal story or about the memorial or anything else that you'd like the audience
to know? I would just encourage the audience, if you're not familiar with the Global War on Terrorism Memorial Foundation or the work that we're doing, or even if you are, but you want to keep up with, you know, the next several benchmarks that we cross, you can visit it. We're pretty easy to find. You can Google us, but we do have a website and you can go to our website and sign up for our newsletter. We usually send out an email once a month, just sharing with our audience what we have going on. And then you can also follow us on social media. We're on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, and X. And if you do have any questions specifically that I didn't cover, feel free to reach out. We'd love to connect.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to put all those links into the show notes. So for the listeners, you can check those out there. And there's contact information on the website and all that stuff too. And importantly too, if any of this kind of resonated with any of the listeners here and you want to support the memorial in any way, there's also donation information on the website as well. So, you know, if that you feel, you know, moved to make a donation, please absolutely go ahead and do that. Every little bit will help. It kind of pushes across the finish line. So Jen, thank you again so much for coming on the show. This has been a wonderful conversation and, you know, thank you again for sharing your story. It's been a pleasure getting to hear a little bit more about it.
Appreciate you. Thanks for having me as a guest.
Yeah, you bet.